Sir, your telegram specified a single. I'd be happy to put you in a double room, sir, if we had any available, but we simply do not. Then the irate customer said, I don't care what the H that piece of paper says, I want a double. Then he started in with that do you know who I am bit, followed with, I'll have you fired, you'll see, I'll have you fired. As best he could, under the verbal tornado, the young clerk injected, Sir, we're terribly sorry, but we acted on your instructions. Finally, the customer, really furious now, said, I wouldn't stay in the best suite in this blank-blank hotel now that I know how badly managed it is, and stormed out. I stepped up to the desk, thinking the clerk, who had taken one of the worst public tongue-lashings I'd seen in some time, would be upset. Instead, he greeted me with one of the finest good evening sirs I'd ever heard. As he went through the routine of processing my room, I said to him, I certainly admire the way you handled yourself just a moment ago. You have tremendous temper control. Well, sir, he said, I really can't get mad at a fellow like that. You see, he really isn't mad at me. I was just the scapegoat. The poor fellow may be in bad trouble with his wife, or his business may be off, or maybe he feels inferior and this was his golden chance to feel like a wheel. I'm just the guy who gave him a chance to get something out of his system. The clerk added, underneath, he's probably a very nice guy. Most folks are. Walking toward the elevators, I caught myself repeating aloud, underneath, he's probably a very nice guy. Most folks are. Remember those two short sentences next time someone declares war on you. Hold your fire. The way to win in situations like this is to let the other fellow blow his stack and then forget it. Several years ago, while checking student examination papers, I came across one that especially disturbed me. The student who wrote the examination had demonstrated in class discussions and previous tests that he was far better qualified than his paper indicated. He was, in fact, the fellow who I thought would finish at the top of the class. Instead, his paper put him at the bottom. As was my custom in such cases, I had my secretary call the student and ask him to come by my office on an urgent matter. Paul W. appeared shortly. He looked as though he had been through a terrible experience. After he was comfortably seated, I said to him, What happened, Paul? This just isn't the quality paper I expected you to write. Paul struggled with himself, looked in the direction of his feet, and replied, Sir, after I saw that you had spotted me cheating, I just went to pieces. I couldn't concentrate on anything. Honest, this is the first time I've ever cheated at the university. I desperately wanted an A, so I worked up a little pony to use. He was terribly upset, but now that he was talking, he wouldn't stop. I suppose you'll have to recommend me for dismissal. The university rule says any student found cheating in any manner is subject to permanent dismissal. Here Paul started bringing up the shame this incident would bring to his family, how it would wreck his life, and all sorts of repercussions. Finally, I said, Hold it now. Slow down. Let me explain something. I didn't see you cheat. Until you walked in and told me, I hadn't the faintest idea that was the trouble. I am sorry, Paul, that you did. Then I continued, Paul, tell me, just what do you want to gain from your university experience? He was a little calmer now, and after a short pause, he said, Well, doctor, I think my overall aim is to learn how to live, but I guess I'm failing pretty badly. We learn in different ways, I said. I think you can learn a real success lesson from this experience. When you used your pony in there, your conscience bothered you terribly. This gave you a guilt complex that in turn broke your confidence. As you expressed it, you went to pieces. Most of the time, Paul, this matter of right and wrong is approached from a moral or religious standpoint. Now understand, I'm not here to preach to you, give you a sermon about right and wrong. But let's look at the practical side. When you do anything that goes contrary to your conscience, you feel guilty. And this guilty feeling jams your thought processes. You can't think straight because your mind is asking, "Will I get caught? Will I get caught?" "Paul," I continued, "you wanted an A so badly you did something you knew was wrong. There are many times in life when you'll want to make an A so badly you'll be tempted to do something that is contrary to your conscience. For example, someday you may want to make a sale so badly you'll think of deliberately misleading the customer to buy. And you may succeed. But here's what will happen. Your guilty feeling will grab hold of you, and the next time you see your customer, you'll be self-conscious, ill at ease. You'll be wondering, has he discovered that I put something over? Your presentation will be ineffective because you can't concentrate. Chances are you'll never make the second, third, fourth, and the many repeat sales. In the long run, making that sale using tactics that hurt your conscience will cost you a lot of income." I went on and pointed out to Paul how an occasional business or professional man loses his grip because of an intense fear that his wife will learn about a secret love affair he is having with another woman. Will she find out? Will she find out? Eats away the man's confidence until he can't do a good job at work or in the home. I reminded Paul that many criminals are captured not because any clues point to them, but because they act guilty and self-conscious. Their guilt feeling puts them on the suspect list. There is within each of us a desire to be right, think right, and act right. When we go against that desire, we put a cancer in our conscience. This cancer grows and grows by eating away at our confidence. Avoid doing anything that will cause you to ask yourself, "Will I get caught? Will they find out? Will I get away with it?" Don't try to make an A if it means violating your confidence. Paul, I'm pleased to say, got the point. He learned the practical value of doing what's right. I then proposed he sit down and retake the examination. In answer to his question, "But what about my dismissal?" I said, "I know what the regulations say about cheating. But you know, if we dismissed all students who have cheated in any way, half the professors would have to leave. And if we dismissed all students who thought about cheating, the university would have to shut down. So I'm forgetting this whole incident if you'll do me a favor." "Gladly," he said. I walked over to my bookshelf, took down my personal copy of 50 Years with the Golden Rule, and said, "Paul, read this book and return it. See how, in J.C. Penney's own words, just doing what's right made him one of America's richest men." Doing what's right keeps your conscience satisfied, and this builds self-confidence. When we do what is known to be wrong, two negative things happen. First, we feel guilt, and this guilt eats away confidence. Second, other people, sooner or later, find out and lose confidence in us. Do what's right and keep your confidence. That's thinking yourself to success. Here is a psychological principle that is worth listening to repeatedly until it absolutely saturates you. To think confidently, act confidently. The great psychologist, Dr. George W. Crane, said in his famous book, Applied Psychology, "Remember, motions are the precursors of emotions. You can't control the latter directly, but only through your choice of motions or actions. To avoid this all-too-common tragedy, marital difficulties and misunderstandings, become aware of the true psychological facts. Go through the proper motions each day, and you'll soon begin to feel the corresponding emotions. Just be sure you and your mate go through those motions of dates and kisses, the phrasing of sincere daily compliments, plus the many other little courtesies, and you need not worry about the emotion of love. You can't act devoted for very long without feeling devoted." Psychologists tell us we can change our attitudes by changing our physical actions, For example, you actually feel more like smiling if you make yourself smile. You feel more superior when you make yourself stand tall than when you slouch. On the negative side, frown a really bitter frown and see if you don't feel more like frowning. It is easy to prove that managed motions can change emotions. People who are shy in introducing themselves can replace this timidity with confidence just by taking three simple actions simultaneously. First, reach for the other person's hand and clasp it warmly. Second, look directly at the other person. And third, say, "I'm very glad to know you." These three simple actions automatically and instantaneously banish shyness. Confident action produces confident thinking. So, to think confidently, act confidently. Act the way you want to feel. Here are five confidence-building exercises. Listen to these guides carefully, then make a conscious effort to practice them and build your confidence. 1. Be a front seater. Ever notice in meetings, in church, classrooms, and other kinds of assemblies, how the back seats fill up first? Most folks scramble to sit in the back rows so they won't be too conspicuous. And the reason they are afraid to be conspicuous is that they lack confidence. Sitting up front builds confidence. Practice it. From now on, make it a rule to sit as close to the front as you can. Sure, you may be a little more conspicuous in the front, but remember, there is nothing inconspicuous about success. 2. Practice making eye contact. How a person uses his eyes tells us a lot about him. Instinctively, you ask yourself questions about the fellow who doesn't look you in the eye. What's he trying to hide? What's he afraid of? Is he trying to put something over on me? Is he holding something back? Usually, failure to make eye contact says one of two things. It may say, "I feel weak beside you. I feel inferior to you. I'm afraid of you." Or avoiding another person's eyes may say, "I feel guilty. I've done something or I've thought something that I don't want you to know. I'm afraid if I let my eyes connect with yours, you'll see through me." You say nothing good about yourself when you avoid making eye contact. You say, "I'm afraid. I lack confidence." Conquer this fear by making yourself look the other person in the eyes. Looking the other person in the eye tells him, "I'm honest and above board. I believe in what I'm telling you. I'm not afraid. I'm confident." Make your eyes work for you. Aim them right at the other person's eyes. It not only gives you confidence, it wins you confidence too. 3. Walk 25% faster. When I was a youngster, just going to the county seat was a big treat. After all the errands were accomplished and we were back in the car, my mother would often say, "Davy, let's just sit here a while and watch the people walk by." Mother was an excellent game player. She'd say, "See that fellow? What do you suppose is troubling him?" Or, "What do you think that lady there is going to do?" Or, "Look at that person. He just seems to be in a fog." Watching people walk and move about became real fun. It was a lot cheaper than the movies, which was one of the reasons I learned later that Mother developed the game, and it was a lot more instructive. I still am a walk watcher. In corridors, lobbies, on sidewalks, I still occasionally find myself studying human behavior simply by watching people move about. Psychologists link slovenly posture and sluggish walking to unpleasant attitudes toward oneself, work, and the people around us. But psychologists also tell us you can actually change your attitudes by changing your posture and speed of movement. Watch, and you discover that body action is the result of mind action. The extremely beaten people, the real down-and-outers, just shuffle and stumble along. They have zero self-confidence. Average people have the average walk. Their pace is average. They have the look of, "I really don't have very much pride in myself." Then there's a third group, Persons in this group show superconfidence. They walk faster than the average. There seems to be a slight sprint in the way they walk. Their walk tells the world, I've got someplace important to go, something important to do. What's more, I will succeed at what I will do 15 minutes from now. Use the walk 25% faster technique to help build self-confidence. Throw your shoulders back, lift up your head, move ahead just a little faster, and feel self-confidence grow. Just try and see. 4. Practice speaking up. In working with many kinds of groups of all sizes, I've watched many persons with keen perception and much native ability freeze and fail to participate in discussions. It isn't that these folks don't want to get in and wade with the rest. Rather, it's a simple lack of confidence. The conference clam thinks to himself, my opinion is probably worthless. If I say something, I'll probably look foolish. I'll just say nothing. Besides, the others in the group probably know more than I. I don't want the others to know how ignorant I am. Each time the conference clam fails to speak, he feels even more inadequate, more inferior. Often he makes a faint promise to himself that deep down he knows he won't keep, to speak next time. This is very important. Each time our clam fails to speak, he takes one more dose of confidence poison. He becomes less and less confident of himself. But on the positive side, the more you speak up, the more you add to your confidence, and the easier it is to speak up the next time. Speak up. It's a confidence-building vitamin. Put this confidence builder to use. Make it a rule to speak up at every open meeting you attend. Speak up. Say something voluntarily at every business conference, committee meeting, community forum you attend. Make no exception. Comment, make a suggestion, ask a question, and don't be the last to speak. Try to be the icebreaker, the first one in with a comment. And never worry about looking foolish. You won't. For each person who doesn't agree with you, odds are another person will. Quit asking yourself, I wonder if I dare speak. Instead, concentrate on getting the discussion leader's attention so you can speak. For special training and experience in speaking, consider joining your local Toastmasters Club. Thousands of conscientious people have developed confidence through a planned program to feel at ease talking with people and to people. 5. Smile big. Most folks have heard at one time or another that a smile will give them a real boost. They've been told that a smile is excellent medicine for confidence deficiency. But lots of people still don't really believe this because they've never tried smiling when they feel fear. Make this little test. Try to feel defeated and smile big at the same time. You can't. A big smile gives you confidence. A big smile beats fear, rolls away worry, defeats despondency. And a real smile does more than cure just your ill feeling. A real smile melts away the opposition of others, and instantly, too. Another person simply can't be angry with you if you give him a big, sincere smile. Just the other day, a little incident happened to me that illustrates this. I was parked at an intersection, waiting for the light to change, when bam! The driver behind me had let his foot slip the brake and put my rear bumper to a test. I looked back through my mirror and saw him getting out. I got out too, and forgetting the rule book, started preparing myself for verbal combat. I confess I was ready verbally to bite him to pieces. But fortunately, before I got the chance, he walked up to me, smiled, and said in the most earnest voice, "Friend, I really didn't mean to do that." That smile, matched with his sincere comment, melted me. I mumbled something about, "That's okay. Happens all the time." Almost in less time than it takes to wink an eye, my opposition turned into friendship. Smile big and you feel like happy days are here again. But smile big. A half-developed smile is not fully guaranteed. Smile until your teeth show. That large size smile is fully guaranteed. I've heard many times, "Yes, but when I fear something or when I'm angry, I don't feel like smiling." Of course you don't. No one does. The trick is to tell yourself forcefully, "I'm going to smile." Then smile. Harness the power of smiling. Put these 5 procedures to work for you. 1. Action cures fear. Isolate your fear and then take constructive action. Inaction, doing nothing about a situation, strengthens fear and destroys confidence. 2. Make a supreme effort to put only positive thoughts in your memory bank. Don't let negative, self-deprecatory thoughts grow into mental monsters. Simply refuse to recall unpleasant events or situations. 3. Put people in proper perspective. Remember, people are more alike, much more alike, than they are different. Get a balanced view of the other fellow. He is just another human being. And develop an understanding attitude. Many people will bark, but it's a rare one who bites. 4. Practice doing what your conscience tells you is right. This prevents a poisonous guilt complex from developing. Doing what's right is a very practical rule for success. 5. Make everything about you say, "I'm confident, really confident." Practice these little techniques in your day-to-day activities. Be a front seater. Make eye contact. Walk 25% faster. Speak up. Smile big. Chapter 4. How to Think Big. Recently, I chatted with a recruitment specialist for one of the nation's largest industrial organizations. 4 months each year, she visits college campuses to recruit graduating seniors for her company's junior executive training program. The tenor of her remarks indicated that she was discouraged about the attitudes of many people she talked with. Most days, I interview between 8 and 12 college seniors, all in the upper third of their class, all at least mildly interested in coming with us. One of the main things we want to determine in the screening interview is the individual's motivation. We want to find out if he or she is the kind of person who can, in a few years, direct major projects, manage a branch office or plant, or in some other way make a really substantial contribution to the company. I must say I'm not too pleased with the personal objectives of most of those I talk with. "You'd be surprised," she went on, "how many 22-year-olds are more interested in our retirement plan than in anything else we have to offer?" A second favorite question is, "Will I move around a lot?" Most of them seem to define the word success as synonymous with security. Can we risk turning our company over to people like that? The thing I can't understand is why should young people these days be so ultra-conservative, so narrow in their view of the future? Every day there are more signs of expanding opportunity. This country is making record progress in scientific and industrial development. Our population is gaining rapidly. If there ever was a time to be bullish about America, it's now. The tendency for so many people to think small means there is less competition than you think for a very rewarding career. Where success is concerned, people are not measured in inches or pounds or college degrees or family background. They are measured by the size of their thinking. How big we think determines the size of our accomplishments. Now, let's see how we can enlarge our thinking. Ever ask yourself, "What is my greatest weakness?" Probably the greatest human weakness is self-deprecation, that is, selling oneself short. Self-deprecation shows through in countless ways. John sees a job advertisement in the paper. It's exactly what he would like. But he does nothing about it because he thinks, "I'm not good enough for that job, so why bother?" Or Jim wants a date with Joan, but he doesn't call her because he thinks he wouldn't rate with her. Tom feels Mr. Richards would be a very good prospect for his product, but Tom doesn't call. He feels Mr. Richards is too big to see him. Pete is filling out a job application form. One question asks, "What beginning salary do you expect?" Pete puts down a modest figure because he feels he really isn't worth the bigger sum he would like to earn. Philosophers for thousands of years have issued good advice, "Know thyself." But most people, it seems, interpret this suggestion to mean know only thy negative self. Most self-evaluation consists of making long mental lists of one's faults, shortcomings, inadequacies. It's well to know our inabilities, for this shows us areas in which we can improve. But if we know only our negative characteristics, we're in a mess. Our value is small. Here is an exercise to help you measure your true size. I've used it in training programs for executives and sales personnel. It works. 1. Determine your 5 chief assets. Invite some objective friend to help, possibly your wife, your superior, a professor, some intelligent person who will give you an honest opinion. Examples of assets frequently listed are education, experience, technical skills, appearance, well-adjusted home life, attitudes, personality, initiative. 2. Next, under each asset, write the names of 3 persons you know who have achieved large success but who do not have this asset to as great a degree as you. When you've completed this exercise, you will find you outrank many successful people on at least one asset. There is only one conclusion you can honestly reach. You're bigger than you think. So fit your thinking to your true size. Think as big as you really are. Never, never, never sell yourself short. The person who says adamantine, when in plain talk he means immovable, or says coquette, when we would understand him better if he said flirt, may have a big vocabulary. But does he have a big thinker's vocabulary? Probably not. People who use difficult, high-sounding words and phrases that most folks have to strain themselves to understand are inclined to be overbearing and stuffed shirts. And stuffed shirts are usually small thinkers. The important measure of a person's vocabulary is not the size or the number of words he uses. Rather, the thing that counts, the only thing that counts about one's vocabulary, is the effect his words and phrases have on his own and others' thinking. Here is something very basic. We do not think in words and phrases. We think only in pictures and/or images. Words are the raw materials of thought. When spoken or read, that amazing instrument, the mind, automatically converts words and phrases into mind pictures. Each word, each phrase, creates a slightly different mind picture. If someone tells you, "Jim bought a new split level," you see one picture. But if you're told, "Jim bought a new ranch house," you see another picture. The mind pictures we see are modified by the kinds of words we use to name things and describe things. Look at it this way. When you speak or write, you are, in a sense, a projector showing movies in the minds of others. And the pictures you create determine how you and others react. Suppose you tell a group of people, "I'm sorry to report we've failed." What do these people see? They see defeat and all the disappointment and grief the word failed conveys. Now suppose you said instead, "Here's a new approach that I think will work." They would feel encouraged, ready to try again. Suppose you say, "We face a problem." You have created a picture in the minds of others of something difficult, unpleasant to solve. Instead say, "We face a challenge," and you create a mind picture of fun, sport, something pleasant to do. Or tell a group, "We incurred a big expense," and people see money spent that will never return. Indeed, this is unpleasant. Instead say, "We made a big investment," and people see a picture of something that will return profits later on, a very pleasant sight. The point is this. Big thinkers are specialists in creating positive, forward-looking, optimistic pictures in their own minds and in the minds of others. To think big, we must use words and phrases that produce big, positive mental images. Here are examples of phrases that create small, negative